Welcome to Delmarva Radio Theater. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Because of the current pandemic, with its lockdown and the prudent requirement for social distancing, our play was produced on Zoom. It's Always the Blood is the name of our drama, and it was written by your host. I want to thank the community players of Salisbury in advance for their assistance with this production. In August 1619, a virus came to the shores of North America. It came on a Portuguese pirate ship that dropped anchor off Jamestown, Virginia, and offloaded 20 to 30 captured Africans who were then sold to the colonists. The virus was slavery, the buying and selling of human beings for the purpose of labor. It came 12 years after the founding of the colony, 1 year before the Puritans landed at Plymouth Rock, and 157 years before the Declaration of Independence. A little over 400 years ago, at colonial Jamestown, Virginia, the virus found a hospitable host and took root in the very soul of this country. The disease it spawned is sometimes dormant, often active, but always latent. We know it today as racism. This play is a fictional story of one of the 388,000 slaves brought to this country. Here now is Act One of our play. The French woman wept, but she took the money. Our play begins in a dank prison cell under a municipal building in New Orleans. The year is 1817, 198 years after those first slaves were sold in Jamestown. Angel Dupree is being held in prison. She is visited by Dorgan Price. He has a message for her.
His high boots were already wet when Dorgan Price descends the last step and stands on the stone floor of the prison. He flicks at a wet smudge on his white breeches, left by a simple brush against the stone wall in the descent. His gesture serves only to drive the stain deeper into the fabric. The turnkey holds his lamp high and to his right points to a small stream of water running the length of a corridor. At the turnkey's direction, Dorgan Price steps over the flow and finds himself before the row of prison bars that follow the current of water at his back now. At the far end of the room, the bars meet the stone wall, partitioning off a large cell. The water gathers into a square scupper and scoots into the wall. The room, more of a place than a room, is beneath a municipal building. The steps that afford its access and the four walls that establish its enclosure glisten, wet in the dull lamplight, like sweat exuded on human skin, secretions of water drawn, leached from the saturated New Orleans soil. There is no sound, only the clinking of the jailer's keys as he pockets the gold coin proffered by Dorgan Price. The coin, paid not for admittance, but to assure his return to the world above. A framed section of the barred partition is pulled open.
Just ring this little bell when you're ready to leave. I'll come let you out.
It's odd, isn't it, turnkey, that in this floating New Orleans city, the dead are buried above the surface of the earth while the living are interred in this putrid soil below.
It's the water, sir. The earth can't hold them.
Then Dorgan Price is inside the cell, the door locked behind him. The turnkey retreats with the lamp, trudges upstream to a small table at the base of the steps. In the dull glow of a lamp hanging from the ceiling, Dorgan Price can see small pools of water on the floor and what appear to be bundles of rags piled against the damp walls of the chamber. As his eyes adjust to the gloom, he can make out the piles to be people, crumbled on the damp straw. Each bundle a person, separate and alone. And then he can see that they are women. Women pushed against the wall, their knees drawn up under them, folded back beneath the rags. There's a soft whimpering now, a hollow moaning occasioned by his presence. Dorgan Price puts his hand to his face. The smell is outrageous.
Angel? Angel Dupree. Angel Dupree.
Who is that? Angel. Angel. Someone's here.
Who is it?
Dorgan Price. I want to talk to you about Rachel.
Dorgan Price? Rachel? Rachel's dead. Years ago. Hanged herself, Dorgan Price. You're doing.
Yes, yes. No, Rachel, your daughter. Where are you?
Go away, Dorgan Price.
No, I know where you are now. I'm coming over. Your husband is dead, Angel. Clay is dead.
Yes, they shot him. What do you know about it?
He wasn't burned alive that night like the slaves you were teaching to read. He was taken first out of the cabin, then you, then the two nuns. The door was nailed shut and the cabin set alight. Any of the slaves who made it out of the fire were clubbed to death. Clay was taken aside and shot. It was a mercy, they said. They didn't burn white men, they said.
Yes. Yeah. Shot.
The Bayou Country, Angel. Another world. You knew that. Not New Orleans, French City, both free and slaves. Educated by the nuns and that priest, Père Antoine. It was the bayou. At night, no moon, no stars. First by carriage, then all of you in the little pea rogue. Silent by stealth, entering deep, then to gather in a Negro cabin on a dirt floor. A solitary lamp in the middle. Windows darkened to teach a bunch of slaves to read. What? Not only that, but a common language. Vocabulary, where they were in the world, that there even was a world, a future. Self-awareness, value, worth, all came with that. The stuff of revolt, Angel. You knew the price, didn't you? An octoroon, black with that 1/8 Negro Algerian French blood.
Yes, and dignity.
Clay, a nobody cabinet maker, furniture builder. It was too close to the insurrection, the last revolt. In the clearing, they just held up the lamp for clarity, lifted their lighter knot torches and shot him. Almost a passing gesture. Nothing more than swiping scraps from a public house table. But you and those Ursuline sisters, a different bucket of catfish to contend with, smelly as you might be.
Nuns?
Yes. Confined to the church for a few days and then resettled, weren't they? Sent to St. Louis, despite Père Antoine and his political sway. Upriver they went, St. Louis, territorial capital, but still the wilderness. But you, the celebrated madam, provider of whores to the rich and famous. By God, rich and famous yourself were a different matter. Even the planters, overseers, torches held up, the cabin ablaze, obedient slaves in the din of screams, carrying out their grisly club work on their own, could see that. So there was nothing, no retribution. A little lecture and you were returned to the big house on South Basin Street, sent back to continue entertaining the elite. Le Vaudor it is, a pleasure palace or sporting club as you called it, made you rich, but hated still. So it wasn't the slaves brought you here, not insurrection, but a simple affront. Just for a moment, you forgot who you are, what you are. Forgot that 1/8 Negro blood that always trumps wealth and fame calls forth the hatred.
Yes, my place.
It was the market, wasn't it? You had just come up from Congo Square, you and little Rachel. Still under the influence of the music, swaying, humming, swishing your skirts. Rachel spinning, pirouetting. She had a bag of pralines, didn't she? Taking one now and then. There were three women all dressed in their Sunday finery. Rachel pirouetted into the middle one, a large, severe woman. No damage except that the pralines spilled out onto the street. Rachel bent to pick them up and you said to leave them. She looked up at you and began to cry. The woman glanced at her two friends, smiled, turned to you and suggested you learn to keep better control of your child. And that would have been it. Turn and walk away. But you glared at the woman until she said, "Wait, I know you. You're that Negro whore from Basin Street." And again, you could have walked away, but you said, "I don't know you, madam, but I know your husband quite well." Still, it would have been over, except, "You fancy Negro," she said. "You and your Negro child, who do you think you are?" And you slapped her. Not a girl slap, not a token slap, but one meant to hurt, to sting, to do damage. So, here you are now, sick, fever-ridden, waiting for your hearing. Assault, they said. 3 months has it been? I suspect you will not leave this place, Angel. You will not go up, up to the land of the living, except to be buried there with the dead.
What do you want, Dorgan?
The child. I came to tell you I've taken the child.
Child? Rachel? My daughter? You have no right.
Yes, I already have her. She's mine by right of transference of the captain's property, the great Gabriel Manuel Oakes. Everything went to mother, and from her to me, everything. Land, farm, all his possessions. It's all mine now, even that precious chest of yours. What's in it? A soiled white linen dress, blue slippers, a small book with indecipherable scratching, and the blue sash they found around Rachel's neck. Your little Rachel is my property now, just as you were my property. The one drop of Negro blood that flows in her veins, that ancient portion out of your heritage, supplants, contravenes by right of law and tradition, the 95% of white blood that sustains her life.
This is New Orleans, French. We are both free.
No, this is not France, and you were never manumitted by the captain. He owned you. You like to think yourself free, think yourself no part of chattel, owned by no man because your will, your soul, would never submit to the block. And you didn't stand on the auction block even in body. The transfer to the French family was made at the dock from the Marseille ship when you were 5, Rachel's age now. Then you were 15, and again, it was a private sale. The captain negotiated. Over 3 days, he negotiated with the French family for a female child of 15, dark with Algerian blood. They needed money. The captain needed. It was money that he had. But still, they negotiated. It was not $250 that he paid. A good price. Not even $500. $1,000 was paid, and that right out of the captain's pocket. In bills from pocket to hand across the sea of disgust and disgrace to the French family. The French woman wept. But she took the money and placed your hand, almost that of a young woman, but really still a child, in the eager hand of the captain. So he bought you, and in the buying, owned you like he owned Three Oaks, his cattle and his horses, to be bartered and traded and sold at his will. And now mine by right of inheritance.
Yes. Yes, he bought me. But I was never owned.
He owned you. Oh, he owned you, and you proved that ownership in the very act of repudiating it with the knife to his heart. From behind, wasn't it? Of course, it had to be from behind. That blow. In a moment of trust, disbelief that you could, that he deserved it.
He was not innocent.
It was Rachel, wasn't it? His disregard, repudiation of her after his wife Mary died. You didn't know, but you saw with disgust his denial of her rights as a daughter, as a woman. Left on some rocky cliff, the Greeks exposed to the elements and wild beasts, the children they did not want. Better you thought that as a child he would have left Rachel to the wolves on the banks of Oconee Lake. That would have been more fitting. His savage turn. Instead, you saw her exposed to years of uncaring servitude, where a final outrageous gale of indifference pushed her to the clearing, the hanging tree.
It was you, Dorgan. You violated her. You told her her brother was sick. Sent her for the soup to get her near his bed. Harley, he was just your surrogate. You stood in the doorway and watched. You!
A captain didn't care. A field ready for the plowing, he said, didn't he? She was more of a slave than you, Angel. She, the only daughter of Gabriel and Mary Oaks, suffered the indignity of slavery. Her mother no longer there to value her, protect her. The captain was innocent. Yes, innocent of her need as a woman, as a human being, and innocent of his own bitterness. She was a possession. A thing no more than one of his fields ready for plowing. But the sons were his possessions as well, not the same as Rachel, but all extensions of the captain, all under his hand. You, the slave, Angel, he owned your body, but you were the only one independent of his will, the only one in whom he tolerated that exception, and so the only one capable of slaying the beast.
You did love me.
Yes, maybe in a deranged way he did. He respected you, and he fathered your Rachel. Little Rachel, who is now mine. Turnkey, I'm through here.
Rachel. Rachel.
Act 2. The truth was that he owned her, lock, stock, and barrel, by inheritance. He owned her. The year is now 1894. Rachel Braxton is an old woman, a widow for 26 years, but fire still burns in her husk of a body.
Rachel Braxton moved to her daughter's home in Boston and is sitting across from her at the kitchen table. A diary, leather-bound, its pages brittle with age, rests open on the table. The exposed page begins. Dead now, house in full flame, consuming all. The past, this moment, and for all I know, the future as well. It is black ink, scratched in haste, melange of French, Creole and Provençal, scratched out by Angel Dupree, the woman Rachel knows now to be her mother.
You asked how they could dismiss me, Abigail. How after living and teaching at the college since its founding 64 years ago, they could just summarily let me go. It happened like this. 2 weeks ago, I was resting in the foyer of the college, waiting for the carriage to take me to the chapel and the annual Dorgan Price Founders Day celebration, when Roger came in and placed a small chest in my lap. He suggested I open it. Inside was this diary. Also a white linen dress, blue slippers, and a blue sash. I read the diary. How could I have known, Abigail? How would I ever have known? The woman in the big hat who haunted my dreams, she was my mother. Not the woman in the gold locket I wore for years. She was a fiction Dorgan made up. That she had died in childbirth was the story I was given. Taken to St. Louis, I was placed with a cultured woman who taught me English and refined my French. Dorgan Price, I took for granted he was my father. The woman in the fancy clothes, broad hat, who took me for pralines, who took me dancing in Congo Square, and who chatted to me in a mix of Gallic tongues, was forgotten. Except in the night, when dreams came, and spirits arrived to whisper worrisome secrets. At the college, waiting for the carriage and the Founders Day celebration, I wondered, what was real? This life, the life that Dorgan Price fashioned for me, the life I built on that foundation, medical school, marriage to Arthur, all of it. The past I had lived under his hand. Or was it the stuff of midnight dreams that mirrored the narrative scratched in black ink in a mixed language that came to me so clearly? What was real, Abigail?
Dr. Braxton. Dr. Braxton, the carriage is here.
Thank you, Roger. Give me another moment, please.
But the carriage, Dr. Braxton, everyone is waiting.
Rachel Braxton lifts the small chest placed now by her feet and rests it next to the book in her lap. She opens the lid and fingers the white linen dress, feels the silk of the blue slippers, and lifts the blue sash to her lips. Her fingers then move to the gold locket pinned to her left breast.
Please tell Reverend Goodhue to extend my regrets, Roger. I won't be joining them today.
But, Dr. Braxton, it's the memorial service for Mr. Price. You've never missed one. All the students, the town folk. It's the memorial service.
Yes, Founders Day. The memorial for Mr. Price. Dead all these years now. I won't be going, Roger. Now, please ask Reverend Goodhue to extend my regrets.
A reason, ma'am, is there a reason I should offer?
Yes, Roger. Tell him. I have a funeral to attend.
A funeral, ma'am?
Yes, it came on rather suddenly. Now go, please.
Thank you.
How is it possible to die twice, Abigail? The first time Dorgan Price died was ridiculous enough. He was shot in the back while he was having dinner in an eatery on the waterfront in St. Louis. It was a Southern sympathizer, thought Dorgan Price was that mayor, Philly. Well, he always wanted to be seen as a fancy established gentleman, so someone finally saw him as that, didn't they? Shot him for it, too. And then, he was dead again. As dead to me as if I had shot him through the heart. This time, there was no sorrow, no sadness, no bereavement, only resentment and confused hatred. Funny, Abigail, I never loved Dorgan Price. He was my father, that I believed, but there was a distance between us. I tried to understand it, but even as a child, there was something in me that would not let me return his affection. I got up, balanced the little chest on my lap, smoothed my black satin skirt, and left the foyer. The bells in the chapel were ringing, but I remember I ignored them and made my way to a path leading to a stand of birch. Through the birch and then a boundary of pines, I found the glade. From Angel Dupree's diary, I knew it was the glade where young Rachel hanged herself. Abigail, this is what Angel wrote. It was a shadow-filled stand of slash pine mixed with oak that bordered a stream-fed pond. I can imagine Rachel looked up, crowned trees arched high above her head, and marveled at the fullness of its majesty and the hard silence it engendered. I know she had never seen a cathedral, but she might have imagined that this was the wonder such splendor would inspire. The glade welcomed her, opened its leafy arms to her. What I found, Abigail, was a circle of dirt, its center dominated by a ring of stones that encircled a fire pit. Two old church pews angled end to end faced the pit. They looked across the stones at a battered couch that had been dragged into place. The tree wasn't difficult to find. The limb was prominent. It held a derelict porch swing that had once been painted white. Suspended by ropes, it swayed gently, even though there was no breeze. Cigarette butts, chewed cigar remnants, beer bottles, and other trash littered the clearing. So much for the cathedral. Charred logs lay black and cold in the stone-circled fire pit. This is now a place for dead things, Abigail. That's what I thought. Used up things. Certainly it was a place for meeting, for revelry, and most likely a place for lovers, lovers seeking darkness and solitude. But what other spirits gathered there? I sat on one of the pews and looked across the dead ashes over the sofa to the swing, closed my eyes, and in my mind, there was Rachel Oakes on the swing. She was so small, her feet dangled above the dusty ground, one little blue slipper hung from her toe. The other had fallen to the earth. She was not alone. Beside her was a woman, slightly larger and a little older. They are holding hands. They are laughing. I can remember now. I'm in a big house. There's a lot of excitement. People come and go at all hours of the day and night. Mostly men, fancy men. And there are women, too. They congregate in the salon, waiting. The men come and they mount the stairs with the women. In pairs they ascend the stairs, the women leading. I can also remember Congo Square now. Praline's, my mother's floppy hat. My mother? Dorgan Price was not there, Abigail. He was never there until he took me away in the carriage. It is with the diary that I've built a past that brought me to the woman in the floppy hat, the big house, pralines, Congo Square, and then again at the tree and its limb. In my mind, swing is gone. Two women are gone. It was only a young girl. She's standing on a box. She's wearing a white linen dress, little blue slippers. She has taken the blue sash from her waist, tied it to the limb, and then to her neck.
Dr. Braxton, what are you doing here? Nobody could find you. We were worried.
Oh, Roger, how long have you been here? I didn't hear you come up.
This is no place for you, ma'am. Those students come down here and carry on. Come back to the house. You're crying, Dr. Braxton.
But you have your knife, Roger?
Right here, ma'am, in my pocket.
And matches. Roger, do you have matches?
Yes, ma'am. Why do you want matches?
Collect some sticks and build us a small fire here in the pit, Roger. We're going to have us a little ceremony. Here, Roger, take the locket. Open it, please. There were two portraits facing each other in the locket, Abigail. On the right was a beautiful woman. On her head, an abundance of curly red hair supported a broad-brimmed shepherdess hat, set off by a black sash and ostrich feather. She wore a coquettish smile that matched a fetching glint in her eyes. Her plunging neckline of the period was bordered with ruffled lace. Expression was one of independence and feminine power. Dorgan Price gave me this locket when I was 15 and told me she was my mother. I loved her immediately. She was a good choice. On the other side of the locket was Dorgan Price. He was nattily dressed in a rich-looking dark coat and a ruffled cravat tied high almost to his chin. Smirk on his face easily be mistaken for a smile. He told me that the miniatures were done on a business trip to Washington by Robert Field. Probably a lie, Abigail, like everything else he told me.
Two handsome people, Dr. Braxton. That Mr. Price, you was some good-looking fella. This woman, she your mother?
Please take your knife, Roger, and remove the picture of Mr. Price from the locket.
Ma'am?
With the point of your knife, pry the picture of Mr. Price from the locket, please. And let me have it.
Yes, ma'am.
Such fine work, Roger. So sad. Now, take the miniature of Mr. Price to the fire and burn it while I say a few words.
That's painted on ivory, Dr. Braxton. It's not going to burn.
Nonsense, Roger. Everything burns. Put it in the fire. I want to watch him burn.
Mr. Price, ma'am, why do you want to see him burn up?
I have my reasons, Roger. Put him in the fire.
The ivory's thin. It might burn, but it'll probably just scorch up. The picture might be gone, though.
Good. Then we'll bury the ivory. Fine now, Roger. Place it so we can see the bastard burn.
Ma'am!
Go ahead, just like that. Nothing's happening, Roger. Why isn't it burning? It's hardly even singed. You won't go away, will he?
Fire isn't hot enough, ma'am. It's ivory. Hard stuff, like I said. We could grind it up, but nothing here for that.
Bury him, then. Dig a hole in the middle of the fire pit. Put him there in the middle of the pit. Let those students roast him every time they come down here and set a fire. Good. Now, a few words. Dorgan Price, if I believed in the eighth circle of Dante's hell, I would consign thee there to eternal punishment. But alas, as much as we would like, there be no farther region of such torment. Weeds and flowers we are all, cut down by time alike. Rest here, then, in this pit of fire. Best we can do till memory of thee is turned to ash. I walked up the path, Abigail, carrying the little chest on my hip, and entered the campus green. The chapel bells were calling the Founders' Day service to a close, and students, faculty, and guests were milling about the entrance and taking refreshments in the foyer. As I passed through them, they stared and followed me into the sanctuary. I mounted the stairs of the chancel, and placed the chest at the side of the pulpit. The leather-covered diary I rested on the pulpit in front of me. I'm sorry I'm late, I said. Please, take a seat, everyone. There are a few things I would like to say. I told them the story. About the little girl, Congo Square, the woman in the floppy hat, the big house, the women and the men who came and went at all hours. I told them my mother was an octoroon, a slave married to Clay Oakes, who was killed in the bayou for slaves to read. I told them my mother was a girl of 15, bought by Gabriel Oakes and taken to his plantation right here, this very place where the chapel now stands, brought here to service his needs. Yes, I told them I have the blood of Africa flowing in my veins. Rachel Oakes, my namesake, hanged herself, not because she was mentally unstable like everyone said, but because she was raped by her brother. Raped at the instigation of Dorgan Price, the founder of this institution. Told of the uncaring father, the murders, the fire, and the flight to New Orleans. I told them the octoroon, my mother, made a fortune owning and operating a whorehouse. Finally, I told them of the famous Gabriel Manuel Oakes fathered her with his octoroon slave. That's all I knew until Dorgan Price took me by the hand. He led me away in a carriage and gave me a new mother and a new past.
Act 3. It had all been lived before.
It didn't take long. It was that same evening. I was in my apartment packing when the note came. The Board of Regents would like to see me. They are convened with the president in the boardroom, it said. Would I please join them? What a mausoleum, Abigail. The boardroom was a dark, austere place. The room smelled of cigar smoke and musty old men. walls that were not covered by shelves of books offered formal portraits of three past presidents, two distinguished professors, and of course, a large painting of Dorgan Price. The nine regents and the college president formed a tableau around an oak table. They were seated. A Negro servant dressed in livery stood against the wall next to an unassuming mahogany liquor cabinet. The top of the cabinet had been raised to reveal a bottle and three decanters. Glasses showing the dregs of an amber liquid indicated the meeting had been going for a while. When I entered, I nodded toward the servant and called his name. He didn't acknowledge my recognition. I was angry and I was scared, but I did not let them see me shaking. "Gentlemen," I said. I wasn't offered a seat at the table. I was clearly meant to stand. 10 men looked up at me. They were not expectant. Evident to me that decisions had already been made. The scene was set long ago. The script written, reviewed, and set before me in their faces. The only choice for me was how to play my part. Say the words, strike a pose, add a nuance or two. It had all been lived before. Amber dregs in 10 glasses testified to time spent. Dead cigars chewed to shreds testified to weighty thoughts pondered. The formal portraits on the dark walls looked on with indifference. The Negro in livery, stiff against the wall, knew everything, revealed nothing. It was a tableau in chiaroscuro, Abigail, worthy of Thomas Aiken's The Gross Clinic, but it's not the leg laid open that interested these men. Only the blood. Always the blood.
Mrs. Braxton.
It's Dr. Braxton, Mr. President.
Yes, of course, Dr. Braxton. The Board of Regents, with my concurrence, has determined that the lies you expressed about our benefactor and founder, expounded before the faculty, student body, and the townspeople, have done significant damage to the heritage of this institution. And despite your long and unique relationship with the college, cannot be tolerated. The supposed book you quoted from is most certainly written by a distraught woman suffering from hysteria and is not to be taken seriously.
He wasn't angry. He was almost matter of fact, blasé even. I was a problem he had set about solving. These are just things that have to be done.
Now, we are not naive, Dr. Braxton, and we admit Mr. Price has always had his detractors. There are questions from time to time about his past, and particularly about his business dealings, but his contribution to this institution and to the greater community far outweigh any scurrilous claims about his character, and particularly those you raise. Accordingly, your account will be suppressed, for the good of the institution, of course. However, the statement of your Negro heritage has traveled like wildfire across the community, and because the account came from you, it will be difficult to counter. This revelation or claim is certainly the largest scandal, but we shall characterize it as the account of an aging woman who was not always in control of her faculties. This one statement of your heritage is of such import, however, that no matter how confused or even false it may be, it may not be expunged from the minds in the community. Doubts and suspicions will always remain. And in fact, the account of your patrimony in this brief time has taken root and grown beyond measure. In some quarters, you are already spoken of as the daughter of an African princess, as absurd as that notion may be. I'm sure you would agree, Dr. Braxton, that this makes it impossible for you to remain a part of the college community, and particularly since you were married to a white man.
Mr. Murray.
The matter is not open for discussion, Dr. Braxton. You were very clear in your statement. And now for practical matters. You will leave the community within the week. A carriage will be made available for your personal use. Roger will supervise the packing of your belongings, which will be shipped to you. A As far as the community is concerned, we will announce your retirement and your relocation to your daughter's home in Boston, where you plan to live out your remaining days under her care. You do have means, and where you actually go is your affair. Please consider your association with this institution severed. You are excused.
If there is no other business, they said, this meeting is adjourned. So I was left standing. The dark afterimage fixed in position in my long black dress. 10 men, devoid of substance, little more than shadows themselves, filed out of the room. Genteel lynching it was. Genteel, but a lynching nonetheless. Yes, it is the blood they can't abide, always the blood. As for your grandmother being an African princess, well...
So it was 400 years ago that slavery was woven into the fabric of this country. It was 172 years ago that an 8-year-old child, Henry Watson, born into slavery in Virginia, was sent to Richmond to be marched to Savannah and sold at auction. It was 161 years ago that the largest slave auction in the United States was held at Ten Breck Racecourse near Savannah, where 436 men, women, and children, their families torn apart, were sold to bidders from across the country. It was 3 years ago that over 2,300 children were separated from their families at the U.S.-Mexican border in an official act by our government, an act of overt racism and official cruelty. It was little more than 2 months ago that George Floyd was killed by police officers in an act of racial impunity. In our drama, Angel Dupree and Rachel Braxton are fictional characters. The 20 to 30 Africans sold into slavery 400 years ago were not fictional. 8-year-old Henry Watson is not a fictional character. The 430 men, women, and children sold in Savannah were real people. The 2,300 children and counting separated from their families at the U.S.-Mexico border are not fictional. George Floyd is not a fictional character. All are real people who had real lives. Angel Dupree and Rachel Braxton are literary characters, but don't dismiss them because they are fictional. As literary characters, they play an important role. They create a virtual reality that reveals the truth of our world. As for Dorgan Price, we thought we killed him off in the second act, but it's clear now he is very much alive and still dwells among us. In 1962, Bob Dylan released a little single that captured the imagination of the world, a series of rhetorical questions that are as relevant today as they were then. Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. But let's give a contemporary twist to Dylan's last line now. The answer, my friend, is marching in the streets. The answer is marching in the streets. Let me offer a special thanks to our cast. From the Community Players of Salisbury, Ken Johnson as the narrator, Michael Murphy as Dorgan Price, Judy Hearn as Angel Dupree and Rachel Braxton, Pete Evans as the Price College president, and joining them, Daniel Foster as Roger, Lee Slater as the woman's voice in jail, and Jack Slater as the turnkey. Thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Radio Theater. This is a production of Delmarva Public Media. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.